Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Breaking Point Podcast. Today, we're here with Erica Komisar. Is that right? Komisar? Perfect.
Yes.
And she is a psychoanalyst, clinical social worker, and parent guidance expert, author of the books Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters, and my favorite one by name, Chicken Little, The Sky Isn't Falling, Raising Resilient Adolescents in the New Age of Anxiety. And I also, as I was looking through, you've got articles published with the Wall Street Journal. So, you know, you're a proper thing. So this is so, thank you for speaking to me. And I think, yeah, that's a good enough of an introduction. Let's get right into you and what made you, what implored you to write 2 books about parenting and why you felt the need to.
Well, I wrote Being There. It came out in 2017, but I started to do the research for that book 13 years earlier. So for a very long time, I was seeing an uptick in mental illness in children and adolescents at a very concerning rate. Sort of more children were being diagnosed at an earlier age. More children were being medicated at an earlier age for things like depression and anxiety and ADHD and behavioral problems. And so I became curious, and I had my own theories about it, but I started looking at all the neuroscience research, the epigenetics research, all the attachment research. And, you know, I knew the psychoanalytic research about what would be behind some of these mental disorders. And they all came together, and that's when I wrote Being There, you know. And what I was seeing was that the children whose primary attachment figures are mothers, generally, it's generally mothers, sometimes it's fathers, but mostly still mothers, but the children whose mothers were not as present for them physically and emotionally were not doing as well. And then I looked into the biological reasons for that, that mothers function as, you know, bioregulators, if you will. They serve a really unique biological function for children in those first 3 years, and that parents also serve a really important function in adolescence, which is the second critical window of brain development, the first being 0 to 3, the second being 9 to 25, or adolescence. And parents were really critical in both of those periods of development. And the truth is that parents are really critical throughout childhood for children's healthy, normal development.
That's a lot of information. But yeah, that's good. So you saw a phenomenon and you questioned and you went into the literature and you thought, right, let's see what's going on. Do you have children of your own?
I do, yeah. I have a 24-year-old son, a 21, soon to be 22-year-old son, and a 19-year-old daughter.
Okay, cool. So they're about the same age as me. In what ways did you treat them differently as a result of the research and your own sort of expertise in this sector? Or did it not? I assume it did impact it in some way.
Well, I mean, I suppose you could say as a psychoanalyst for many years. I mean, I've been in practice for 32 years, more than that, maybe now. And so I did this long before I had children. And so my sensibilities were already geared towards the importance of nurturing, and also not just nurturing, but a particular kind of nurturing, a sensitive, empathic, mirroring, emotionally reflective kind of nurturing. So I was already geared towards that, you could say. And then the research that went into my book only reinforced what I already knew. But, you know, but also I think people do need evidence-based, you know, psychoanalysis is more of an inferential, more of an art than a science. But attachment research is a hard science. Epigenetics is a hard science. Neuroscience is a science. And so I think people needed evidence-based sort of proof of the things that I knew to be true, that I worked on with my patients. And so that's what made the book so important. It gave people evidence based proof that your physical and emotional presence is critical to the future mental health of your children.
What is psychoanalysis? And what was the other one I was going to say? You said neuroscience and I've forgotten. What is psychoanalysis specifically for anyone that doesn't know?
Yeah, I mean, psychoanalysis is I would say it's the study of, but it's the practice, it's the study and practice of looking more deeply at the motivations and origins of people's mental health issues, meaning rather than just looking at them behaviorally or superficially, really thinking about them in context of the whole person and of the history of the person. So the idea that one's internal states are reactive to one's environment, and so that both the environment that you grow up in, the relationships you have, as well as your internal states that react to them are important. Whereas many of the ways that people are treated today, and kids and adolescents are treated, is very behaviorally. And there is a, you could say, more superficially treated. And drugs are really just superficial because all they are symptom relief. They don't really get to the heart of the matter, as we say. And cognitive behavioral therapy also can be very helpful in certain situations with certain kinds of kids. A nonverbal adolescent, for instance, might not be able to talk about their feelings. And so things like DBT and CBT can be very helpful. But when you can get an adolescent or a child to talk about their feelings or to be in a play state with you, to be playing and working with a dollhouse or a sandbox or a water box or doing art or, you know, you are really getting more to the meat of the matter. You're getting more to the causes, because one would say that we're mostly led by our unconscious, not our conscious state of mind. So when you sit down and do CBT with someone, you're really dealing with someone's conscious state, which is important, but you're not really getting to one's unconscious state. So Freud, who was the father of psychoanalysis, really said that unless you get to someone's unconscious state, you're not really going to heal that person.
Yeah.
So that's what psychoanalysis is. It's retreating someone, not just, you know, not ignoring the present, focusing on the present, but really connecting it to their past and their past losses and their past traumas and relationships that may have, you know, maybe meant to be well-meaning, but may have done harm.
Yeah. One of the things that I see with the kids that I'm working is their level of dysregulation. And I think technology must have a lot to do with that. And I believe it was Freud who spoke about the notion of sort of multiple kind of sub-personalities in the unconscious that are kind of disconnected. And as we grow up, it's about, I guess he believed it was about, you know, he talked about the id, and it was, he talked about subject
ego and
the id and the ego and the superego, and he talked about how the id needed to be subjugated to the higher sort of levels of faculty, I suppose, and then Jung came along and he was more in the case of, no, they need to be integrated, not subjugated. That's the wrong word. It's not about suppressing something, it's about incorporating it in. And it's, and that is a tricky process to go through, and especially for kids. And especially for kids who are, you know, maybe quite high in neuroticism, and, you know, if their base temperament is starting from, I guess, from a minus position in the sense of they're at a disadvantage in terms of emotional regulation, that is something that's really, you know, we walk through that part, we walk down that path, everyone, as we progress, the notion of unifying ourselves under one collective sort of, I don't know, spirit or something. It's a very difficult phenomena for children to not associate themselves and to take a step back. And I guess that's what you talk about. You talk about how that's the role of the mother predominantly. It's they act as that intermediary between the child's emotions and the real world. So, and I'm seeing that cropping up a lot, and it's really important that we get that right. Why the first 3 years of life?
Well, by 3 years of age, 85% of your right or social emotional brain is developed. And so in that critical period of development, the environment plays a great role in the development of the brain. So if you don't have what's called a sensitive empathic nurturing environment in the first 3 years, it impacts the brain development negatively. So, and there are two critical periods of brain development, because what we know is that the prefrontal cortex, or, you know, I guess you could say the ego, in Freud's terms, he didn't think in terms of neuroscience, but the regulator of all things, the regulator of the threat sensing part of the brain, the regulator of impulses, the regulator of executive functioning, the regulator of judgment, the regulator of emotions, really doesn't fully develop till 25 years of age. And it's actually older in boys. It's about 28 in boys and 25 in girls. And so we were only able to identify this part of the brain and see how it really is not fully developed until 25, only since the 90s, right? So because of the neuroscience developments and the technology and things like fMRIs, we were able to see the brain in real time. We were able to see the electrical input. We were able to see the blood flow. And that helped us to really understand that the concept of critical periods of brain development. The first 3 years is, you'd say, it lays down the foundation of a child's personality, of their character, and of their emotional security for life.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the 25 and the 28. I didn't realize the 28 for men, but that does make sense because, you know, even with all the kids that I've seen growing up, the girls are always at least 2 years older than the boys, maturity-wise and emotional intelligence-wise, although I don't really like that phrase. And you see this with celebrities as well. You see it. There's a lot of celebrities who end up like dying of an overdose at 27 or end up committing suicide at 27, or they have some form of, I guess, you know, tipping point, breaking point that sends them down or says spiraling off into a new path. And whether that's a good or a bad one is often dependent on the person. I think if you Google like celebrities that died at 27, there's loads of them. It's like Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse. There's a few, but that's interesting. And that probably isn't spoken about enough, that notion of fully brain development at 25 and 28. But I suppose that's hard in the society that we live in, because, you know, you're going to just let people do nothing for 30 years and then something go right off you go. There has to be an integratory sort of process into the, I suppose, I know that's not what you're saying, but it's complicated, isn't it?
Well, it's meant to promote understanding rather than, you know, and that understanding helps us to understand things like, you know, policy and laws and, you know, what should be taken into consideration when we make laws and create policy in a country like the UK or America, you know, around drugs and alcohol and, you know, even school start times. I mean, there's so many things that we can do that are based on understanding of development, that if we don't understand the development, we can't do.
Absolutely, yeah. It's the desire for monetary gain is both something that is a blessing and a curse at the same time, the degree to which that is influencing the way our society is run. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of, it gets very political about what's going on, and let's not talk about politics because that's not what's important. You've spoken about the release of chemicals differently, difference between men and women and mothers and fathers. What is that difference and why does it occur, do you think?
Meaning the difference in the way mothers and fathers nurture based on their
hormones? Yes, nurturing, yeah, based on their hormones, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, mothers and fathers produce nurturing hormones. Women and men both produce nurturing hormones. And they actually produce the same nurturing hormones to varying intensity and degree. But those same hormones have a different effect on their behavior. And so, for instance, women produce oxytocin, which is the love hormone, which they produce when they give birth, when they breastfeed, and when they nurture their young. And the effect it has on their behavior is to make them more sensitive and empathic nurturers. So when a baby is in distress, it makes them very fine-tuned to the baby's distress, right? Makes them tune into the baby's distress. They hear it in a different way. They respond to it if they're healthy mothers. And I always put that as a caveat because mothers who have been denied sensitive empathic nurturing is a trauma which then is passed down generationally, not genetically, but generationally. So that means that mother may not be able to hear the distress of their baby. But in a healthy mother, oxytocin makes that mother, bonds the mother to the baby, helps the mother to fully attach for the first 3 years. And helps that mother to become a more sensitive, empathic nurturer. Oxytocin, which is also found in men, is produced from a different part of the brain to a lesser degree. And when they do produce it, it makes their behavior more what we call playful, tactile, stimulating behavior with babies. So fathers will tickle babies and throw them up in the air, more physical roughhousing play, more exploratory play, and it's a different kind of interaction with babies and toddlers. And you can see this just by observing. You can see the difference in the way that fathers interact with babies and toddlers than the way mothers interact with babies and toddlers. If a father stays home with his young to nurture, be it the primary attachment figure, which is happening a lot, he generally produces more oxytocin because that's what happens. The more time you spend around babies, the more oxytocin you produce. But it still makes him more like a father than a mother, if that makes sense. So it makes him into a hyper father, tickling the baby more, throwing the baby up in the air more. That doesn't mean fathers can't be taught to be sensitive and empathic nurturers, but it doesn't come as naturally based on their hormonal behavioral patterns, right? So, and then there's another hormone called vasopressin, which is called the protective aggressive hormone. Again, it's found both in men and women, but more in men than women. And it helps fathers to protect their families from the dangers of the environment. And that's why it's called protective aggressive, a protective aggressive hormone. Mothers also produce it, but to a lesser degree, because most mammals in nature rely on the fathers to protect the family unit, whereas the mothers are focusing on the nurturing. So it's, these hormones don't necessarily dictate the outcome, but they're very important to understand. Because if we are going to have fathers staying home and caring for children as primary caretakers, then we have to educate them and I would say veer them away from the roughhouse play exclusively and more towards sensitive empathic nurturing. So it is important research. The other thing that's important is that oxytocin is a protector, a buffer for cortisol. So the more oxytocin that is flowing in a baby's and a mother's brain, the more protected they are from stress. And we know that stress is not good for babies' brains, and it's not good for mothers' brains. So oxytocin protects from cortisol. What we also know about oxytocin is that the higher the oxytocin levels, This is interesting research. The lower the testosterone levels. So when a father nurtures,
that makes sense.
Primary nurturer, right, he loses some of that testosterone, which is, so we say testosterone is a hormone which promotes mating behavior. Oxytocin is a hormone which promotes nurturing behavior. And so the more nurturing a father is, the less, and, you know, again, the research is still being done on this, the less sexual he will become. So we have to really wonder, do we really want our fathers all staying home and becoming like mothers? Because, you know, are they then losing libido, which, you know, what happens to society overall? So there's a lot of complicated questions. That's why I think when we just sort of lump everybody together in a basket and say everybody's the same and, you know, none of this stuff matters, I think society is at risk without understanding the neuroscience behind our behavior.
Yeah. And I suppose there's kind of a similar, isn't there a similar phenomenon with women that they're drawn to certain pheromones during ovulation or during, maybe during pre-pregnancy and then, or something along with the lines of when a woman is pregnant towards the end of her final, maybe in her final trimester or not sure when, she alters her desire, her, she loses interest in her partner and becomes more interested in
yes.
people who have a more similar, releasing similar RH factors or the baby. Okay, yeah.
Or the baby. I mean, so there's something called maternal preoccupation, which mothers have, which, you know, fathers, again, this is why it's important. If young fathers understand, it's not that my wife doesn't love me. It's not that she doesn't love sex anymore. But right now she's nurturing our baby. So her interest in sex is going to be reduced because nature says, while you're nurturing, you shouldn't be having another baby. And so, you know, what nature does is it says, right, reduce the libido in women. You know, so you'll often hear women saying, you know, I have my baby and I don't really feel like having sex with my husband and he wants sex and I don't want sex. And I'm like, well, that's because, you know, that nature is dictating to you that you shouldn't reproduce again. And nature is still dictating to him that he should.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
And this is not what I'm advocating, but lions live in prides. So we don't live in prides. Thank goodness, because we need, you know, human beings are interesting mammals. We need a lot of security. And so we live not in family units with multiple females and one male, like, you know, like lions do. But what happens with lions is they'll leave the mother who's nurturing their new young alone and they'll go to another female. And we don't work that way because we have one partner. And so, and that means there has to be a greater understanding in husbands, boyfriends, whatever. If my wife, my partner, is nurturing our young, she may not be as interested in sex, but that's not a rejection of me. That is actually a healthy investment in this baby that we want to be emotionally and mentally healthy in the future. So I'm not going to take it personally. I'll do it on her terms when she feels like it, and I won't pressure her and won't feel, you know, won't feel so rejected by it. So yeah, interesting, right?
Yes, very interesting. And that is kind of a necessary evil, I suppose, on multiple levels, because the alternative is what you just mentioned with the lions. It's more, I think it's polygyny, which is one man has access to multiple women, which is humans are more polygynous from a historical perspective. I'm pretty sure it's something like we have 80% of our ancestors are female and 40% are male, and the way it works out is every woman had one child and every man has two. So one of the things that religion has done, and I guess kind of society, Western society, Western society to some degree, it's promoted monogamy. And there's loads of data that sort of shows how monogamous societies do better, because if there's the more men that have less access to sexual relationships and romantic relationships, they become more infuriated, and it causes more crime and more domestic abuse, and it imbalances society to a great degree. So, you know, what you just spoke about is a necessary evil, or something, not evil, but it's a part and parcel of a better functioning society. If that
of a more stable society. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, a more stable society. Yeah, if that isn't rejected, and you know, the dangers of. So, okay, so that leads me on to the next question. Are you getting a lot of? I was going to ask this at the end, but I'll ask it now. Are you getting a lot of kickback from what you're saying here? Because you must be. Oh. I'd have thought you were getting quite a lot of kickback. Yeah.
I mean, damn. From the first book. The second book was more of an educational book for parents, and I don't think it wasn't as controversial because it,
yeah.
You know, the first book, I think, made a lot of women in particular, but men too, feel guilty about their choices. And, you know, as a psychoanalyst, what I would say is that guilt is a signal feeling. It's not a bad thing. We don't want to sweep it under the carpet and never feel it, because it's a function of a properly working ego. If we don't feel guilt, it means that we don't have a conscience. So we want to have conscience, and particularly around our children,
of course.
We want to feel conscience. So, but, you know, excessive guilt is not something that's healthy. But guilt is like physical pain. If you are playing football or rugby and you break your ankle and it hurts, you stop playing on your ankle, you get medical care, and you rethink how you played the game, right? Maybe. And when we feel guilt, society tells us, no, don't feel it. It's bad for you. Just brush it aside and move forward. Power it through, women and men. And the thing is, guilt is a signal feeling that you have internal conflict that's unresolved, and that you have to pause and stop and look at what you're doing and think about it and really process things. And we don't encourage people to see guilt as a signal feeling. And so, you know, for me, if women were feeling guilty from my first book, it was a sign of success, because it meant that they were reflecting and potentially feeling conflicted and reflecting. But so that's where the controversy came in, is that, you know, women don't like to feel challenged in their choices, and neither do men. Because remember, you know, the paradigm of a mother being with her child as much as possible in the first 3 years demands that she has extended family support, that she has support from her spouse, that she has support from her extended family, that she has support from the government. Yep. It suggests that to raise healthy children, you can't do it alone. And that means you have to have your husband or your spouse on board. Right. And there's a lot of young men who, you know, are also struggling with this idea that my wife is supposed to stay home with my child and not bring in money and not be a high functioning professional. And you mean I got to go out into the work world and she gets to stay home with the baby? You know, it's this kind of thing. And I'm like, well, if you want to have a healthy child, then you want to create as much emotional security for that child as possible. And if that means, as a young man, that you have to take on more of the burden of the protective aggression, being out in the world while your child is going through these critical periods of brain development, so be it. So a lot of this gender neutrality that young people are being taught is really confusing everything, I think, because we're not the same. We both have horrifically important functions to play. Fathers are amazingly critical for children. You know, we could do a whole nother hour on fathers. Fathers are very important for children. When fathers aren't around, mothers regulate emotions like sadness and fear and distress. fathers regulate aggression. So when little boys in particular don't have fathers around, they don't learn to regulate their anger and aggression. And they end up having behavioral issues and attentional issues. And so fathers are important. They just aren't exactly the same as mothers.
Absolutely not. That makes sense. I was going to say something, but I've forgotten. I'll go back to the other thing. Yeah, it's interesting you talk about shame. And another thing of shame is that it's a societal construct of society has made you feel shameful about something, so you can just brush it aside. It's because society is, it's society's fault you feel like this. And maybe occasionally that is true, but I think less than we're led to believe, actually. I think. What's your opinion on, because Freud said the good mother fails. And I've encountered in the schools that I worked in, you know, very, very rarely, but occasionally, you know, something like Munchausen by proxy. And what's, and I suppose it was either Freud or Jung who coined the term the overbearing mother, or the, the overbearing mother. What's your opinion on that? And how does a phenomenon like that occur? And what role could a father play in deterring against that?
Well, overbearing mother assumes either anxiety or aggression. Either that mother is not aware of her aggression towards her children. You know, there's a lot of women who, you know, say, I love you, I love you, I love you so much, I could eat you up. You know, there's a lot of aggression in a lot of mothers that isn't acknowledged. So it could be aggression. You know, that's a possibility. It could also be anxiety, right? So when we say a helicopter mother or an overbearing mother, we're not talking about a healthy mother. We're talking about a mother who struggles. So what you really need for a good enough mother, as Bruno Bettelheim coined that phrase, the good enough mother, you want to have someone who can healthily attach and healthily separate. You need both, right? It's the yin and the yang, right? You need a child to have healthy attachment, but you also need that child to have a parent who's healthy enough to let go as well. And so sometimes you'll get children where the mothers attach very intensely, almost merge with the children and can't let go of them. And that's when you find those kind of anxious connections. So that's not what I'd call healthy or good enough parenting. Yeah.
Oedipal mother, that was the phrase. Oedipal mother, the Oedipus complex.
Well, I mean, you need the Oedipus complex. The Oedipus complex is just a romantic attachment to your opposite parent. But that when the attachment can't be released by the mother, when the mother doesn't release it, sometimes that happens when the mother and father don't have a very strong connection. Meaning, if the mother and father are not that strongly, intimately, romantically connected, then the mother over attaches to the child in a romantic way and then can't let the child go, right? So you bring a child into the world, and you know, for some mothers they can fully attach, but then they can't let go. And that's the kind of mother that Freud was talking about.
Yeah. And that's obviously a hard thing to do, I can imagine. For a mother, you know, your own flesh and blood, your own children that you've raised, and then you have to have the strength of character to allow them to go into
let go.
The world.
And yeah, that's right.
Let go.
Not control
get
everything.
Get kicked down a few times. Why do you think society, because I think society, it implores women to think in a way that, backwards is a strong word, but there's a lot of encouragement now that for young women that casual sex and engagement in those sorts of things, you know, OnlyFans, promiscuity is empowering. And then as they get older, it's a case of working for some faceless corporation earning 40 grand a year is also empowering at the expense of, you know, sacrificing your relationship, you know, a long-term committed relationship. And then raising children. And I understand everything I've laid out is a very conservative lifestyle. And obviously, a lot of what we're seeing nowadays is a kickback against conservatism in some ways for the right reasons. And then, unfortunately, it's been exploited out into the wrong for the wrong reasons as well. And, you know, the Barbie movies was a pretty powerful, which I thought was absolutely not good, the Barbie movie.
No,
the message it was.
I would agree with you.
Yeah. You know, it was, yeah, it was quite worrying, actually. The notion that women are being oppressed into being mothers and actually would rather go out and, I mean, fair enough, but, you know, all the statistics actually point to women being a lot unhappier now than they were back in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Which is something that, you know, any avid feminist should look at and, you know, really scratch their head over what that means. Although I suppose probably everyone's more depressed now than they were in the 1960s, possibly. I don't know.
Well, I think the 1960s were a time when women didn't have the choice to choose whether to have children, because if they didn't have children, they weren't considered part of society. Now the pendulum has just swung.
It's that choice, isn't it?
Right. Women have the choice, but many of them are making poor choices. So there are many women that shouldn't have had children in the 1960s and should have had careers instead of having children, and were really
absolutely
mothers, and yet they were forced to have children, and the children were suffered a lot from that. Today there's a choice of whether to be out in the work world or have children or combine the two. But I think what you're noticing is correct, that I think a lot of women are not making the best choices for themselves. The pendulum's really swung too far. You don't want it to go back to the 60s where women didn't have choice, but you want them to make better, more metered choices. And, you know, yeah, that's what I would say about that. You know, that 60% of women, at least 60% of women in America, more than 60% actually, say they want to stay home with their babies in the early years and mother them themselves. And yet we don't have policies in our country that support them to do so. And so 60% is a very large number. But does that mean the other 40%? Yeah. So, and maybe the other 40% shouldn't be having children. They should be having careers instead of children. And so, you know, it kind of, it's the idea is choice, and we want to give women choice, but I think, yeah, the pendulum has swung too far.
Yeah. I read or listened to a stat that says something like 80% of women who wanted to have children 80% of women who don't have children wanted to have children, and they go to like counseling sessions and they grieve over the families that they never had. And I've watched videos of women talking about how no one, you know, they can't find a partner and they can't have kids now because they've reached a certain age, and they this whole concept is such a controversial, I suppose, although it shouldn't be, but it's become such a controversial and finely nuanced phenomena that it's, you know, it's really hard. But you're spot on about a percentage of these women just they don't have the temperament. They're not agreeable.
They don't want to make the sacrifice. It's a sacrifice to have children if you want to raise healthy children. And so, you know, and they're not either, because their mothers were not that nurturing, and or, you know, again, the choice to give to the world and be generative in a different way. They want to be generative by, you know, starting companies or starting nonprofits or they want to be generative in other ways. And that's fine. I think the choice is really important. But I think what's happened is we've pressured women. I think that Barbie movie was sort of, hope it was meant to be satire. But, you know, there's an aspect of it that is about, what have we done to the value of mothering in women's minds? Have we killed the value of mothering in women's minds? So they don't really understand the choices that they're making.
Yeah. And another thing is kind of, we haven't even brushed on, which, you know, the second you have children in life, your life is no longer about you, it's about them. And yeah. You should, if you're a good parent, you should do everything you possibly can to make sure that they have the best possible life that they could ever have. And if that offends people saying that, meaning that mums, it's more difficult for one parent to work, doesn't really matter. If that's what, there's a lot of evidence to point towards, that's what has to be accepted. And if you're going to find that offensive, it is what it is, but it's not about you.
No.
It's about kids.
No.
And it's about, you said, the natural state of motherhood is unselfishness. When you become a mother, you are no longer the center of your own universe. You relinquish that position to your children. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's such an important thing. The notion of the idea of sacrifice and, you know, giving up something of seeming value for something of more value, mm-hmm. and, you know, purpose and meaning, all things that we've lost a lot in the world. And people are crying out for, you know, your children. I'd imagine, for the little experience I have working with kids, is having children is something that is a massive contributor to that. And your career is, you know, I've worked with so many women who, you know, just the other day, there's a woman, young, it must be 32 or something. She's got a 2.5-year-old, and I asked her, what did you do before working here? And she said, I was a teacher at school, an art teacher at school near, and now she's a teaching assistant. And it's like, well, yeah, it makes sense why you're a teaching assistant, because you want to have more of a relationship with your children. And there's so many women there who either their kids go to the school, so they work at the school, so they can pick them up and take them home. They can work around school holidays. You know, and all this is unfortunately put under something like the gender wage gap, which is a fallacy and doesn't exist. And it's all such a shame that it's just a shame that these ideas are promoted. Or there's probably a small degree to which the gender wage gap is true, but there's so many other reasons as to why it's a phenomena. And I'd imagine what I just laid out is quite a big part of it, because, you know, your career isn't the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, there are the glass ceiling issues, which I think are still issues in big corporations, which are male dominated, right? So you still have those glass ceiling issues, and, you know, but I would say that a lot of those statistics are skewed by the fact that women go into what's called women's work, and the reason that they do that is because it allows them, you know, teaching. Helping professions, nursing, you know, because it allows them to be there more for their children. And so that skews that statistic to make it look like women are victims. Yeah. And I think, as you say, many times women are choosing work that is less demanding, but can still earn a salary so they can prioritize their children. And so one would say that women's work is a wonderful thing for women to do when they're raising children. It allows them to still work and not be pressured. And so what we've done is we basically said to women, unless you're doing men's work, you're a failure. And men's work never allowed men, nor does it allow men, to be with their children. So that way you have two people in a family doing men's work, and neither one of them is with their children. And that's what's happening to our children.
Yeah. And also, you know, women are often higher in trait agreeableness from a personality Big Five perspective. So, you know, they're more interested in being compassionate towards others. And men are often, on average, less agreeable and more interested in things. And that leads them down the path of going to STEM. And, you know, I watched a video, and this guy worked in an American university or college, and they said they ran a program to get women to take STEM classes, because you take classes in America at college, don't you?
Yeah.
And it just didn't work. They couldn't increase the numbers, because, you know, just women are far, on average, far more interested in people than they are in things. And anyone with any sense knows that, really. if you just spend time with women and you watch them, the way they talk and the way they interact with things, and that's been turned into a negative when it's not a negative.
To a negative is supposed to be positive. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's a real shame because it's more stigmatizing than we realize, ironically. Why do you think divorce rates are going up, and what are the dangers of fatherlessness and the notion?
Fatherlessness is a problem because, as I said, without fathers, children kind of lose the ability to regulate other kinds of emotions. So if you say that one of the main purposes of parenting is to help regulate children's emotions so they can later internalize the ability to regulate their own emotions, then a family without a father, children don't necessarily learn how to regulate aggression. You know, there's also the issue that marriage provides a kind of stability. Marriage is still the best way. It's still the ideal. And this is a politically incorrect thing to say, but the marriage, all the statistics show that marriage is still the ideal for raising healthy children. Does that mean that children who come out of divorces or who aren't from, you know, nuclear families can't be healthy? No, of course it doesn't mean that. But the statistics are higher with mental disorders in children who come from families who are divorced. Partly that's because those families, you know, I'm writing a third book on divorce and how to raise healthy children through a divorce. Partly it's because people don't know how to divorce in a healthy way. As you said, they put themselves first, and their own needs first and their own emotions first, and they don't put children first. If they put children first, divorce wouldn't be an ideal, but it wouldn't have to be the end of the world. But it really is destructive because of the way most people go through divorces, that you'd say they have very unhealthy divorces. But definitely the statistic says that marriage is still the best way to raise children.
Yeah. And once you have kids, you never really get divorced, do you? Like you get divorced, you separate, but you know, if you want your kids, unless you don't want your children to grow up with one or the other parents, you know, you're always going to be in some form of contact within to some degree. And a lot of the people that I know who grown up with divorced parents, they live like literally 5 minutes away from one another. So, you know, and I think that as come back to my earlier point, it has to be about the children, and that's why that makes sense to you. You prioritize their needs above your own, and that's part of the sacrificial element of parenthood, which is what's been transmuted into a negative act as opposed to as a fulfilling and purposeful act. So in a video I watched, you made a very good point, which was you chose the word prioritizing for a reason, which is for the in the first 3 years, and
yeah,
how it shouldn't be a case of abandoning career, right, or other aspects of your life, but prioritizing the role of motherhood. What do you think is a good alternative if you could decide, if you had free rein over what to make the new legislation, unlimited money, and you could say, right, based on the evidence and based on, I suppose, my opinion, but maybe, well, yeah, probably very similar, what would you say is the perfect amount of time, interaction, and configuration of the dilemma of, you know, separating mother and child and encouraging and empathizing, all of that combined within the first 3 years and going forward? Big question. I hope you get the gist of it. Do you get the gist?
Yeah. So, I mean, what I would say is paid maternity leave, full paid maternity leave for the first year is realistic. I'm a realist, you know, unless you live in Estonia or Slovenia, where they have up to 3 years of paid maternity leave. That's just not going to happen in our society. Even 1 year is hard to fight for, but at least 1 year paid maternity leave fully and then the other 2 years either partially or you know, giving women the opportunity in the in their work to work part-time so they can still prioritize their children in the second and third year. So that would be ideal. And if the father is the primary attachment figure, then it should be the father who has those same opportunities. Because sometimes mothers just do not have it in them to mother. And sometimes they don't even realize it until they have their children. And then, you know, abandoning babies into institutional care is a mistake. It's destructive to those babies. But if a father is more nurturing than the mother, then the father should have the same right and access to those resources as the mother. That's what I would say.